There are a lot of foods and crops iconic to Wisconsin, but it's hard to think of one with more cultural significance than wild rice. Hi, I'm Clara Neipert. Thanks for joining us on the West Side this morning. The wild rice harvesting season is just coming to a close, so we're taking time today to reflect on this season and discuss the challenges ahead for this Wisconsin grain. Joining us today are Peter David from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission and Jason Fleener from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Before we begin to talk about wild rice, we're giving you a coronavirus update. We're joined by Liska Giese, director of the Eau Claire City County Public Health Department. She and I had a conversation yesterday. Hi, Liska. Welcome back to the West Side. It's great to have you on again.
Hello to you. It's great to be back.
We know that more than half of Wisconsinites have completed the COVID-19 vaccine series, but the latest COVID numbers represent a steep increase in cases from earlier in the summer. According to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, 56 counties have a very high disease activity level, and that includes all the counties in our listening area. Liska, what does that mean when the DHS says a county has a high disease activity level?
Yeah, it is. It's a pretty powerful map when you see it, when we're at this level of disease. The state health department has been calculating this disease level based on two different things. One is the number of cases we've had in the last 2 weeks within that county, and then whether the trend is going up, going down, or staying about the same. All of our counties have had a really high burden of disease, so the number of cases in that two-week period. And really, that's what's driving things right now, is we are seeing a lot of positive COVID-19 cases, and at a level that in Eau Claire and all of the surrounding counties, we're at that very high level now. Very high means that somewhere between 350 and 1,000 cases per 100,000 population. So it's a rate, and it's a lot of cases in 2 weeks.
Hmm. And what sort of precautions are Eau Claire County taking in response to that status as a high disease activity level area?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely are continuing to pay attention to the numbers. Yesterday, we had 82 new cases in one day. So certainly in Eau Claire and our surrounding counties, we are really naming to people that disease spread is happening and the basics are still true. Wear a mask when you're in a group of people, especially indoors. Make sure you are watching your symptoms and getting tested right away if you have any symptoms or you're a close contact to someone that is COVID positive. And really importantly, if we want to slow down spread, if you are positive for COVID-19, stay home and make sure you're staying home for your full 10 days. And make sure you name who your closest contacts were so that they stay home. We know that this is incredibly contagious. So Delta variant with COVID-19 is very contagious. And the likelihood, if you're a close contact, for you to get COVID is pretty high right now. The only way we stop that spread is by not being in contact with the next person. And that's really what we're asking for.
Yeah, you mentioned that Delta is more contagious than other strains of the coronavirus. That said, do we know how big of a factor the Delta variant is in our county's case rates? Is there any way that we can track or measure that?
Yeah, we know across Wisconsin that likely the majority of cases of COVID-19 now are Delta. State Lab of Hygiene, our partner at the state level that looks at cases, really has named that at this point what we are seeing is Delta. At an individual level and within our county, we don't track that information. So if you get tested for COVID-19, you won't get a result that says it's Delta or not Delta, but you can be confident right now that it likely is.
Since face coverings use declined late last spring, there has been a rise in return of many common respiratory viruses we didn't really see a lot last year following the widespread safer at home orders in the spring of 2020. So there's concern that there will be more transmission of respiratory sicknesses in the coming months. So keeping that in mind, if we're feeling sick, how should we determine when or whether we should get a COVID-19 test?
So our encouragement is that if you have any level of symptoms right now, those symptoms that are different than usual, cold level symptoms, fever, loss of taste and smell, upper respiratory symptoms. So those are, you know, those basics that are out there, that you get tested. And we are seeing other respiratory viruses or other viruses that make you have a runny nose, a cough, those kinds of symptoms. And in many cases, it's important to get tested for more than one thing. We'll be seeing more of that as we enter influenza season, and the likelihood that we will be seeing potentially people with both influenza and COVID, or one or the other, when they have symptoms.
Statewide, the DHS reports that more than 90% of hospital beds are in use. Liska, what do hospitals in Eau Claire County look like? Do they have a lot of space?
So in Eau Claire County, we know that our hospitals are doing an amazing job, and they are fielding patients from all over the area. They aren't just hospitals that have Eau Claire County residents in them. At this point, our data is tracked at a regional level rather than just at an individual hospital level. And hospitalized patients have increased drastically over the last number of weeks in Northwest Wisconsin. Both hospitalizations overall and ICU hospitalizations are indicated as growing in this area. Our hospitals are asking people to continue with basic strategies so that we keep the number of COVID patients as low as possible. Their capacity issues are not only related to COVID-19, they are also related to all kinds of other things that we need hospitals open for. And they have capacity issues because of staffing. So all of those things together make it difficult. And our partners in healthcare really are asking all of us at a community level to work together to make sure that they have the care available as we move forward into the fall, especially knowing that we typically get increased need for hospital beds during that time frame.
Nearby Clark and Taylor counties have the lowest vaccination rates in Wisconsin. What are health departments, like yours in Eau Claire County, continuing to do to encourage people to receive that vaccine?
One of the best strategies we all have is vaccination. And while some people are choosing not to get vaccinated, we continue to clearly see from the data and from the research that's been done that getting vaccinated means that you are much less likely to be hospitalized and die. So again, going back to the hospitalization question, our goal in the end is that we don't have a lot of COVID-19 cases, but more importantly, that we don't have positive cases that end up being hospitalized and dying. So vaccination is the route, the path to get us there. Health departments across the region and across the state are working together to make sure we have vaccination options available. And that isn't just from health departments, pharmacies, healthcare, and many other partners are working together on that. For example, on our website, you can go and find where you can get vaccinations from all kinds of places in Eau Claire County. But if you go to vaccinate.gov, in any county in the state, you can find a vaccination option. We also know that we have people that still do need to be vaccinated, and age groups that are at a level that is lower. So health departments are also leaning in hard to make sure that young people particularly have options to be vaccinated, and groups that right now have lower rates, whether they are racial or ethnic groups or other populations.
The Biden administration has said that booster shots will be available to adults this fall, maybe around September 20th. who should get a booster and what does that time frame look like? Like, how long after I've been vaccinated should I wait to get a booster?
Yeah, booster vaccines are the discussion of the moment and important for us to pay attention to. At this point in time, we don't know what the national decision will be on when a booster is needed and who needs to get it. It is certainly something that we are tracking closely at a local level, as well as the state tracking that. There will likely be a decision in the coming weeks, we anticipate, about that. What we're doing right now is getting ready for that. We know that with many vaccines, a booster is needed. If that is needed with COVID-19, we want to be ready for it. And again, we have a lot of people in Eau Claire County and across the region that we hope are interested in having that booster vaccine when it's determined that that's the important next step.
People with long COVID have new returning or ongoing symptoms long after they've had or initially been infected with COVID-19. Liska, what do we know about COVID long haulers?
Yeah, COVID long haulers is certainly something that is being looked at really carefully right now. We are learning more every day with the research that has been done. It's hard to remember that this still is a relatively new disease, and certainly as we are seeing over time, there is a proportion of people that have been infected, about 1 in 10 right now, that seem to have symptoms that last significantly longer than just what would be considered a typical viral disease. Those symptoms can vary from person to person, and it's also not entirely clear now if it's connected to getting sicker with COVID initially. It does seem that some people, even that have minor symptoms, have very long-term impacts with COVID. But it might include breathing difficulties, fatigue, difficulty concentrating, and headaches, so some of those neurological symptoms, sleep problems, and ongoing change in taste and smell. So some things that are really significant, and certainly we are watching carefully. We don't want anybody to get COVID-19. We certainly don't want to see hospitalizations and deaths from COVID, and that's the vaccination push. But we also are really carefully watching that if we have long-term impacts, this might be something that we are dealing with for a very long time.
And what can someone do if they think they are a COVID long hauler?
Yeah, I would certainly talk to your healthcare provider right away. There is research going on right now. There is careful review of that. And certainly a healthcare provider is the first step to exploring that.
Well, school's back in session, and we've read reports that there are surges in cases at schools. For example, earlier this month, there are 228 students and staff quarantined in the Stanley Boyd School District, which is in Chippewa County. Liska, what do parents need to know about keeping kids safe from COVID-19 in schools?
So I think everybody in our community and in communities across the state have the same goal of keeping K-12 students in school so that they can learn. That's the best place for them. At the same time, we want those environments to be as safe as possible given COVID-19. Many children in schools, that population of 5 to 4 to 11-year-olds can't get vaccinated right now. So they are certainly the space where we see COVID-19 circulating. We don't want kids to be in school that are potentially getting sick and potentially spreading COVID-19 from the school to families and friends outside that environment. The basic guidance in schools is very similar to the guidance that we have for everybody else in the community. Wear a mask, use multiple other strategies to protect yourself. So distance and masks being the most important ones, along with vaccination, if you can be vaccinated. So a large percentage of kiddos in schools, and certainly the faculty and staff, can be vaccinated, anybody that's 12 and older. So we really recommend first vaccination if you're able to, and then additionally masks and distance, and making sure that those that are not well or are close contacts are tested. So lots of strategies happening with school, including testing, masking, vaccinating, and maintaining as much distance as possible.
Liska, thank you so much for joining us today on the West Side to fill us in about COVID in our region.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Liska Giese is the director of the Eau Claire City County Public Health Department. Next, we're talking about this fall's wild rice harvest with representatives from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Do you have questions about how to protect wild rice in our lakes? Or maybe you harvested wild rice this season. How did that go? Well, you can join this conversation by calling 715-471-6490. That's 715-471-6490. Or by emailing us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Clara Neipert. This is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Larry Mueller Show comes up at 11. There are so many beautiful hydrangea varieties to choose from, it's hard to know what to pick. Larry talks about how to find one that works for you and how to keep it healthy. That's the Larry Mueller Show next on this station. Coming up next week on the West Side, we'll take a look at the NFL's most storied franchise, the Packers, from the hearts of the fans. WPR's Shireen Seewert, Rick Ryer, and Ezra Wall will present The People and Their Packers. Whether you're a cheesehead or a fan of the Bears, you're invited to tune in next week at this time. Well, fall is harvest time for farmers across our state. The corn silage harvest is already underway, and the time for soybean and corn for grain is just around the corner. This time of year, it's common to see combines flattening rows of brown corn. Stands selling pumpkins and gourds pop up on the roadside. Behind all this hubbub, there's another crop that's quietly harvested in some parts of Wisconsin, wild rice. It isn't grown in gigantic fields, but in calm lakes and waterways. And instead of being harvested by roaring machines, it's carefully and dutifully picked using a pair of sticks. Today on the West Side, we're talking about wild rice and all of its agricultural and cultural glory. Here with us today are Peter David, a biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Welcome to the West Side, Peter.
Good morning, Claire. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we have Jason Fleener, a wetland habitat specialist at the Wisconsin DNR. Good morning, Jason.
As always, good morning, Clara.
Good morning. As always, you're welcome to join this conversation by calling 715-471-6490 or by emailing us at ideas@wpr.org. Well, let's start with the basics. Peter, where does wild rice grow?
So wild rice is an annual aquatic grass, and it grows in about a half a foot to 3 feet of water in places with sort of a mucky bottom, and with this flow. So you find it on river meanders, on shallow lakes or marshes that have rivers flowing in and out of them. But on a bigger scale, on sort of a global scale, it's interesting to note that northern wild rice, the one that we're really interested in human harvesting, is limited to North America, and in fact, only to a small part of that. And in the U.S., only northern Wisconsin and Minnesota really have wild rice in any abundance. So that sort of makes us the global stewards of this plant in this region.
Is there something special about Wisconsin that makes it be the place for wild rice?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure that anyone's got a great answer for that. Whether it's something that, you know, just evolved on this part of the landscape and has specific enough requirements that it doesn't spread well. It does have a very limited dispersal ability. And so maybe that it's one of these things that on sort of a global scale is still not reached a very large distribution and maybe never will.
Jason, I'm wondering, what does wild rice taste like?
That's a good question. It's always difficult to describe a taste. I've had wild rice quite a bit myself as being a harvester. You know, some people will describe it as kind of an earthy or nutty taste. It really doesn't taste much like a white rice. It really doesn't taste like that at all. But I know that there's a lot of mixes of different types of rice, but you really have to isolate the wild rice to really get its full flavor. But in my opinion, there's nothing that really beats it.
Peter, why did you start to study wild rice?
Well, I guess it was a little bit by accident. I always had a natural interest in wildlife ecology, so I pursued a couple of degrees that way, but I wasn't really introduced to Manoomin or wild rice until I began working for the tribes at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. And this was in the Ojibwe worldview, one of the more than human beings that's tremendously significant to the tribes. And so it was a high priority for them to try to steward this resource. And I feel really lucky in retrospect to have had the opportunity to spend a good part of my career doing that.
And you also harvest wild rice. How did you learn to do that?
Well, I could, I think, thank the tribal elders for that introduction to that process. I did know very little about it when I first started working for the tribes, even though this was part of Wisconsin, which is where I grew up. People who get that introduction, I think, oftentimes develop a really long-lasting relationship with it, and that certainly includes me and my family.
Jason, what about you? How did you become interested in wild rice and protecting wetlands in general?
Well, so I've been working for the Wisconsin DNR for about the last 16 or 17 years. So I've had a number of jobs in the wildlife management program. So out of college, I graduated from University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. I had a wildlife degree, and with that, I had a water resources and soils minor. So with that combination, I grew interested in wetlands. And so in 2011, I took a job in the Wetland Habitat Program, and as a big component of that is wild rice management, really critical not only for people but for wildlife as well. So that kind of exposed my interest in rice, and then some folks that I used to work with introduced me into harvesting, and I've been hooked since.
Peter, earlier you mentioned that in Ojibwe, wild rice is called Manoomin. Translated, that means the good berry. Why is it called that? Why is it referred to as the good berry?
Well, Manoomin has tremendous significance to the Ojibwe, you know, on both sort of a practical level and also on a deeply cultural level. On the cultural side of it, it really goes back to the tribe's migration story. When the people were living at one time along the eastern seaboard, and actually it was certain prophecies given to individuals that said that if they were going to survive as a people, they were going to have to undertake this westward migration. And they didn't really know how far that was going to go, how long it was going to take. But the prophecy was they'd be at their destination when they came to the place where the food grew on the water. And that food, of course, is Manoomin. And when they reached the western Great Lakes region, the wild rice bowl of the world, that became literally a religious motherland. But on the practical side, it also turns out that this food is extraordinary food. There's no other single food that carries as much overall nutrition as Manoomin. And when it's properly harvested and prepared, it can be kept fairly indefinitely. So it became that critical mainstay subsistence food to get you through the hard times.
Today, is there still that cultural importance in the Ojibwe culture?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's still oftentimes, the first food, solid food given to babies. It's a food that is provided for the journey to the afterlife. And it really tends to be present at every significant feast and ceremony in between. So it very much still has a iconic, really kind of cultural identity role, I think, for the Ojibwe.
What are some of those ceremonies that are associated with wild rice?
They all are, I think I would say. All of the things that are significant life events, I think, to the Anishinaabe or Ojibwe person, you will find rice present at those things typically.
We've talked a little bit about how people enjoy and value wild rice, but let's talk for a second about animals too. Jason, what role does wild rice play for many of Wisconsin's wildlife species?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very ecologically important for a variety of wildlife species. So not only wildlife, but fish. So if you think about it, this is a grass that grows in shallow water, so in marshes and lakes and rivers, a lot of different types of ecosystems. So for fish, for example, once the rice is growing, once it becomes emergent out of the water, it provides a really good nursery bed for fry and for young fish and for hiding spots. So as for wildlife, rice hosts a lot of different types of insects, which a lot of other animals prey on. Rice is especially important for a lot of different migratory birds. So first that comes to mind are ducks and geese. I would say it's probably one of the most important food sources for migration for ducks. So not only dabbling ducks such as teal and mallards, but also diving ducks such as ringneck ducks, really rely on this seed. So once it drops from the plant, it goes into the bed of the water, and then from there, the ducks will go down and grab it. And so this is a really high energy food source for migration. So not only in fall migration, but also in spring migration. But yeah, there's a host of other wildlife species that really depend on these rice beds. It's really clever. You think about other types of birds. There's a rice bird, which is actually the saurah rail, that really relies on that sort of cover as a secret of marsh bird. Muskrats rely on rice for building huts and for food. That's just to name a few. So there are a lot of different species that depend on it.
We're talking about the ecological importance of wild rice today on the West Side. You can join this conversation by calling 715-471-6490 or by emailing us at ideas@wpr.org. Now let's talk a little bit about the harvesting process. Tribal members from the Lac du Flambeau Ojibwe have harvested wild rice from the lakes of northern Wisconsin, but this year they say that there's less rice to be found. The story comes to us from producer Aaron Gottsacker at WXPR in Rhinelander.
Wild rice, yeah, Monomin. It was food grown on water, and that's what was told way back when, you know. I'm Joel Gravine. Born and raised here in Lac Flambeau. I work with the wild rice program here for the tribe, manage it and do all the field work. Nowadays, when we go to harvest, we jump in a canoe, we roll up our pants. I wear a long sleeve shirt, you know, a thin shirt, so you know, some days it's 95 degrees and we're out there harvesting rice and it's hot, and you get the little tails on the wild rice, you know, when it's ripe, some of those little tails are 1.5 inches, 2 inches long, and it gets pretty itchy. A lot of times you got little spiders and, you know, what they call rice worms, and that's a big issue now. So we got two people in a canoe. We got one guy paddling or poling, and we have the other guy. We got some rice and sticks made out of cedar. We call it a knocker. So what we do is we just hit it, you know, or knock it, you know, like that, or some of us are pretty good. So we just kind of we got a rhythm. We just go kind of like on an angle, you know. Got ripe rice, it'll fall off. So then, a lot of times, some what they'll do is they'll have like a bed sheet or a tarp or, you know, canvas. They'll fit in the bottom of the canoe, so then they knock the rice into that. And then we call rice bags, and then we just put our rice in there and tie it up and head for home, and then we'll lay it out. Sometimes you can have 3 or 4 tarps out there on the lawn, you know, and then we spread the rice out when we get home and kind of let it air dry. And so then nowadays, you know, a lot of us, we kind of got modernized, you know, so we got these thrashing machines. Now they got these fancy ones. You have to they got the thrasher and they roast it at the same time. So there's some fancy operations out there. It takes 10 minutes at most to cook rice. You know, if you just want plain rice, 10 minutes. We make like chicken wild rice soup. We got wild rice casseroles, you know. There's all kinds of different kinds of soups. There's a thousand and one different ways you can prepare. It don't matter where, you know, whatever event we got going on here in Lac du Flambeau, whatever, there's always wild rice. There's always wild rice, there's always deer meat, there's always fish, you know, there's berries. You know, you might have a couple of Oreo cookies, a packet of Oreo cookies there, you know. It's identity. You know, it's who we are, you know, as Anishinaabe people, Ojibwe people. It's spiritual. It's told in our prophecies where we were supposed to go, where food went on the water, you know, grew on the water. And this is where we ended up, Great Lakes region. And this is why we're here, you know, in Waswaganin, Lac du Flambeau. Historically, we had roughly 25 to 40 lakes that had wild rice, and now we're down to two rivers. So. We had like, I think maybe 60 pounds finished rice. And the year before, we had a little over 80 pounds. And the year before that, we had probably about 120 pounds of finished rice. So something's going on. It all depends on where the water levels are at and what the nutrients are in the lake bottom or river bottom. So we will fight to protect what's important to us. And Manoman wild rice is important to us.
Thank you to WXPR in Rhinelander and producer Aaron Gottsacker for the use of that story. Well, Peter, reflecting on Aaron's piece, how does your own experience harvesting wild rice compare to Joe's?
Well, it's much the same. I mean, the process of harvesting hasn't changed much, really, in centuries of this pattern of two people working together, the poler and the quote-unquote knocker. It's often overlooked a little bit, the role of the poler. Typically, when ricers are working together in a canoe, you might think that the person actually doing the physical harvesting is most important, but the individual propelling that canoe is actually doing a lot, reading the bed, looking for the right height, the right maturity, listening to the rate that the rice is dropping into the canoe and adjusting the speed and the tempo, and then working very methodically when you're in a good location. The other big thing about ricing is that rice plants mature gradually over a period of time. So you really want to rice in Ojibwe parlance again, in a good way, being gentle to the plants and only taking what's ripe and ready to be harvested. Because if you do that, then you can come back in a couple of days and harvest that same patch again. And, it's all kind of a wonderful process, and that rhythm that Joe talked about is really interesting, and you hear that and you feel that when that's going, you know, things are going well. I've heard some great stories in the past of at times when a number of canoes might be out on the same lake, then another canoe would go out with a drum in and actually keep a beat that people would rice to. I would think that would have been an amazing thing to experience.
Joe also touched on what's done after harvesting. Peter, how do you process the wild rice to get it to be table ready?
Yeah, that's a lot of work. There's multiple steps involved. Even though picking rice itself is a bit of a task, much of the work remains after that. And traditionally, you have to do some sort of drying and then parching the rice to drive moisture out of it. And then there's a threshing to remove the hull that surrounds each individual grain. And then separating that chaff from the grain. Those steps have been mechanized to various degrees, and mostly by sort of small, what I call sort of family or mom and pop operations. And while some rice harvesters will go through all those steps themselves, many others will take their rice to professional finishers who will do those steps for them, either for a fee or for a percentage of the rice, you know, an in-kind payment, if you will, for that work.
By now, most of Wisconsin's wild rice has been harvested. Jason, what did this season look like? What did the harvest look like this year?
Yeah, I think I just have anecdotal reports so far. So overall, quite frankly, we did not have a great crop this year, and we haven't for a few years. So, but there are always good spots to go. There are some lakes that really produce. So if, you know, folks do their homework, they can find a place that can really produce rice. So I think there's a lot of unknowns yet. So Peter actually coordinates a wild rice harvest survey that's sent out to people who purchase licenses. And so for folks at harvest, we really encourage them to fill out that survey because that tells us a lot of information about the harvest and how the crop was in any given year. So that data is really important. So we'll probably learn more over the next few months here about how the harvest really went.
Jason, what environmental factors can influence a harvest? For example, I've read reports that this year's harvest is harder for corn and soybean farmers who say that the drought caused their plants to suffer. So does that impact wild rice?
It can, but probably in ways that you wouldn't expect. Sometimes a drought can actually be a good thing for rice. And by that, I mean that if water levels are too high, rice does not germinate and grow well. But if it is low enough, so if in a drought you have a low enough water level, it could actually provide the sweet spot for rice growth. However, the challenge that we've seen this year, especially in northwest Wisconsin and particularly in Minnesota, is that it's been so dry that the rice has grown throughout the growing season, but the lake levels have kept dropping to the point where access has been difficult because those beds of those lakes and marshes has been so dry that you can't get out by canoe to harvest the rice.
Peter, Jason just mentioned that you sent out a survey with the Great Lakes Fish and Wildlife Commission to measure the abundance of wild rice. In the last 10 years, what have those surveys shown you about the health of wild rice beds across the state?
Yeah, so we really do kind of two types of surveys. We do abundance surveys, which are mostly aerial surveys of the rice beds scattered across the state. And then we'll do a post-season harvest survey that Jason mm-hmm. mentioned. And both of those provide sort of important insights into rice across the state. It's always interesting to me to sort of compare what we're seeing on the landscape now with the TEK, or traditional ecological knowledge, that the elders share with us. And I'd say the last 10 years have been pretty discouraging. Particularly in north central Wisconsin, more than in the northwest, but we've had actually a cycle here where the last decade has been far above the normal in terms of precipitation, and lake levels in many areas have been very high. And again, as Jason indicated, even though this is an aquatic plant, that's actually not often a good thing, and moderate drought is often the thing that triggers the best crops. In northwest Wisconsin, though, we're also seeing other kinds of challenges. We've had some, you know, really major storm events, for example, that what used to seem to be a 100-year storm now seems to be coming much more frequently. And we've had actual infrastructure failures, dikes or water control structures fail after 7 or 8 inch rain events. We're seeing some disease outbreaks that are probably associated with unusual wet and humid conditions with rice. So it's been a challenging time, and I think there's a lot of reason to be concerned about the future and the moment on the landscape.
We're talking about the challenges that wild rice face today on the west side. Our guests are Jason Fleener from the Wisconsin DNR and Peter David from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. There's still time for you to join this conversation. Call 715-471-6490 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Claire Neipert. This is the West Side on the Ideas Network. Spectrum West is back this week at 10 a.m. Thursday. Al Ross shares interviews highlighting the best and most interesting in the world of arts, culture, humanities in Western Wisconsin. That's the focus of Spectrum West Thursday at 10 on this station. Thursday, October 14th at noon, join WPR Special Projects reporter Bridget Bowden and WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson for a free virtual conversation about WPR's new podcast called Mapped Out. Secret meetings, deleted documents, and a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, Wisconsin's 2011 legislative redistricting process was anything but routine. Join the creators of Mapped Out for a behind-the-scenes look at the reporting that went on into the six-part investigative series that is debuting in September. You get the lowdown on redistricting past and get ready for redistricting present in this live virtual event. You can submit your questions, too. So you can register online at wpr.org/presents. Well, today on the West Side, we're talking about the wild rice harvest in Wisconsin. Climate conditions typical for the Midwest have already changed in ways that we can all notice. The winters are warmer, we've experienced heat waves in recent years, ice on lakes and rivers is forming later in the fall and melting earlier in the spring. Scientists say that the annual and seasonal temperatures will continue to increase in the Midwest. They also say that precipitation patterns will change. Peter, how do you foresee climate change impacting wild rice?
Yeah, I think this is just a huge issue, Clara. And, you know, if you just look at the common name of this plant, northern wild rice, it's sort of this hint that this is a plant that's adapted to grow under fairly harsh northern conditions. And just about every prediction of change associated with climate in the future brings a negative with it to wild rice. So these more frequent, very heavy rainfall events, more frequent hail events, just different distribution of precipitation throughout the course of the year. Temperature changes are probably going to be a big thing, and humidity changes. There's a disease called brown spot disease, for example, which is a fungal disease that has been around for a long time. It's something we used to see sort of here and there now and then, but it seems to be becoming more and more prevalent on the landscape, and we see these fairly major outbreaks of it at times. So it's just a great challenge. And even things, you know, that you might not think are a problem, like a longer growing season, actually just tends to mean that wild rice becomes less competitive with plants that are better adapted for that. And it also tends to bring along actually more competition with invasive species, because the milder the conditions become, the more of those kinds of species oftentimes are able to compete with rice. So this is a major problem, I think, for rice going forward on the landscape. And it's one really that's very difficult to address.
Jason, I want to get your perspective on this too. What do you think in relation to climate change and wild rice is in store for the future of this grain?
Yeah, I think Peter really hit on the highlights. I think some climate change vulnerability assessments have indicated that wild rice is one of the most vulnerable species compared to a lot of other species found in the north. Another thing to mention is ice cover is really important, because if you think about the ecosystem, wild rice has to grow amongst a lot of other aquatic plants. So if conditions are such that it's too warm, or if there's not enough ice cover, a lot of the perennial types of vegetation are going to thrive, you know. So if you think about your water shield and lily pads and aquatic plants like that, they're going to outcompete wild rice unless you get a good harsh winter and harsh ice cover to kill off some of those perennials. So that's another threat too to consider.
And I would just add too, it's interesting that for many grain crops, when they're growing in higher CO2 levels, they find that the nutritional value actually decreases. And I'm not aware of that work being done for Manoman yet, but I think there's a high likelihood that's taking place. And so, it's sort of an intense hit to communities who still place a lot of value and take a lot of their nutrition from their plant.
We're getting a question from a listener. They're wondering, are there efforts to introduce or reintroduce rice into lakes? Peter, I'll let you respond to that.
we'll both want to probably talk about this because there are efforts to restore rice, and they're very cooperative. The tribes work with a wide host of organizations, including the DNR, the Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, private organizations like Ducks Unlimited and Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, local lake associations. And there's really a long list of potential partners here. And there were, I think, especially some gains with rice. We have done some very successful restoration or recovery programs in certain locations in western Wisconsin. The Crex Meadows Wildlife Area has a couple of wonderful spots that I'll let Jason talk about. But there's also been great work. Clam Lake in Burnett County is one of the flagship rice lakes in Wisconsin, and that one went into a major decline in what's really an interesting ecological story, where the immediate problem was a big increase in the carp population there. But it probably had its roots in a decline in the pan fishery. And when the bluegill population crashed, they were effective predators on carp eggs. And so there was this cascading effect that led to the rice going into a major decline. The St. Croix tribe worked with the Lake Association, with its state, and with others in that region, and there's been a really remarkable recovery there. And it does give you an idea that there are some real values in putting a focus on this resource and stewarding it for the future.
Yeah, Jason, can you give us an idea of some projects happening in western Wisconsin to restore lakes?
Sure, absolutely. Like Peter mentioned, Crex Meadows Wildlife Area is probably one of the properties on DNR land that we've ceded the most over history, and it's required a lot of work over time. So in conjunction with water level management, repeated seedings are really important to have a long term success in those beds. But there are a lot of natural lakes as well that seeding or restoration projects have taken part on as well. And Glyphwick has been a really key player in helping to coordinate a lot of those seedings in the past. But one of the other biggest projects going on right now is on the St. Louis River estuary near Superior. And DNR and a lot of cooperators with the tribes and folks in Minnesota have really put in a lot of effort to seed those beds. So hopefully we'll have a good success story to talk about soon there.
Jason, what are the conditions that are right to seed wild rice? What needs to happen for it to take root?
Sure, that can be a tricky thing. Well, I think Peter talked about some of the conditions that rice require earlier in the broadcast. Rice needs an organic bottom. You know, ideally, if water levels are somewhere between the 6-inch to 3-foot range, that's where you want to target your seeding, where water levels are on average. But it requires a lot of water level management if you have the capability of doing a drawdown. So if you can seed ideally on a flowage where you have the ability to control water levels for management of rice, that is the ideal scenario. But anyone can seed wild rice, really. We just ask that they ensure that it is a native seed source of wild rice, not a cultivated wild rice. So another consideration, you know, if private citizens want to seed rice, you know, that's encouraged. You know, we just hope that folks consider where they're planting. So if you think about where wild rice is going to grow, you don't want to be throwing it next to somebody's boat dock or in front of a shoreline where there's a cabin where that neighbor might not be welcoming of rice. So be considerate of where you put it, but ideally somewhere where it has a gentle flow of water, if it's a lake with an inlet or outlet, kind of around those areas.
We've been talking a lot today about the DNR working with area Ojibwe tribes to determine regulations and when rice should be harvested. And in fact, much of the regulation and protection of wild rice in Wisconsin is done through that tribal and state partnership. Peter, how would you characterize the relationship between the DNR and the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission?
I think this is, Manoomin's been a great resource in some ways, because it tends to be very much a win-win thing. But the tribes off reservation treaty rights were first really reaffirmed. I think there was a lot of concern among some of the public There weren't long-time relationships existing between the tribes and some of the other natural resource agencies. And the Manuman work actually, I think, had this great benefit that not only did it do good work on the landscape in terms of bringing some rice back, but it really built some positive relationships between the tribes and other agencies that, you know, hopefully carry on into today and into the future, and also sort of branch out into other areas. You know, we certainly have our challenges at times on various issues, but this is one that can, I think, be an example about the benefits you can get from really trying to co-manage some of these resources in the ceded territory.
Thanks for joining us to learn more about wild rice and get your COVID-19 update. I'd like to thank our guest, Jason Fleener, the Wetland Habitat Specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Peter David, a biologist at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. I'd also like to give thanks to Lisa Giese, Director of the Eau Claire City County Health Department, and Aaron Gottsacker and WXPR Rhinelander. Rick Ryer helped produce today's program. Kate Springer is our on-air producer. She also manages publicity. Coming up next week on the West Side, we'll take a look at the NFL's most storied franchise, the Packers. A couple of folks from WPR will present the people and their Packers. Have a great weekend. This is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio.